So the next time that you hear me attacked as a socialist, like tomorrow, remember this. I don't believe government should take over, you know, the grocery store down the street or own the means of production. But I do believe that the middle class and the working families of this country who produce the wealth of this country deserve a decent standard of living and that their incomes should go up, not down. I do believe in private companies that thrive and invest and grow in America, companies that create jobs here, rather than companies that are shutting down in America and increasing their profits by exploiting low-wage labor abroad.
That was, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders in his big speech last week, attempting to fully define, at long last, democratic socialism. Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, colleagues.
Hello.
Happy Monday.
Hi, Matt.
Yep. Bernie and 19 of his Democratic presidential contenders will finally be on stage together over two nights next week in the opening bid of a sure-to-be-endless debate season, not making the cut, according to the complicated maths of the Democratic National Committee, were Montana Governor Steve Bullock, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, Miramar, Florida Mayor Wayne Messam, why is he running, and 88-year-old performance artist Mike Gravel, so pour 40 out for the socialist teenagers who are running Gravel's Twitter feed. Since we're at the end of the pre-beginning of the Democratic presidential season, I thought it was an appropriate time to take stock of what we have learned.
We're entering, is phase two of the Democratic cinematic universe.
In the pre-chatter, we're not going to do this. Catherine, what have we...
Who's Aquaman?
That's DC.
Oh, we're doing this.
Yeah. Oh, well, I would say, wait, are we doing DC or Marvel? Then who's Thanos?
Elizabeth Warren.
Who's naked
Matt,
Thanos?
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Catherine, well, what have we learned so far? What's the biggest thing that's jumped out to you so far in this Democratic race?
The biggest thing that has jumped out to me in this race, she said, answering the question by repeating the question in the best interview manner, is that apparently Democrats like free trade and immigration now, which I'm excited about. I mean, it's obviously lies is too strong a word. It's not lies. They really do like talking about how they like free trade and immigration now for a minute, because what they like doing is scoring points against Donald Trump. Joe Biden is out there trying to turn free trade into a campaign issue, apparently. Because the trade war is bad. And you know what? Joe Biden is right. Trade war is bad. It's bad for Americans. It's bad for people abroad. It's bad for everyone. Shuka Dalmia had a great piece last week about how Democrats have never been more pro-immigration. Both the Democratic electorate, which consistently polls more in favor of immigration than it has for years, and several of the Democratic candidates who have spoken up in favor of expanded legal immigration, as well as various forms of amnesty for some subsets of illegal immigrants, in contrast, for instance, to the Bill Clinton administration, which abolished amnesties, and in contrast to Barack Obama, who deported record numbers of illegal immigrants.
So, I think you're definitely right when it comes to immigration. And you're right when it comes to the Democratic electorate about free trade. But the number two and number three candidates in the Democratic race so far, and yes, the polls are early and all that.
Permanent asterisk.
For at least another year.
Yeah,
I mean, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are talking about bringing back industrial policy. Trumpy when it comes to trade, and they're doing well.
And I think Kamala Harris, to the extent that the other kind of top tier people talk about, with the possible exception of Buttigieg, are also definitely leaning away from free trade to heavily managed trade. I mean, the daylight between them and Trump.
And yet,
at the same time,
we have the dubious Joe Biden saying Trump doesn't get the basics. He thinks tariffs are being paid by China. Any beginning econ student at Iowa or Iowa State, interesting, could tell you.
Just to pick any random college.
Could tell
also,
you
Grinnell
the American
as
people
well,
are paying and, his tariffs. Iowa. That is a very pointed and economically literate thing for a Democratic candidate to say, particularly at this point in the campaign.
Democratic frontrunner.
I think, you know, to go back to Matt's larger question, to me, what's jumping out is the consensus, actually. And again, Biden is an interesting outlier because he's obviously leading in the polls for, you know, various reasons, including name recognition. But his policy prescriptions seem to be very much at odds with what I think is emerging as a consensus among the Democrats, which is that trade needs to be managed much more so, that immigration, we need to be more humane. But none of the people, and even in the clip from Bernie Sanders, you hear the echo of him sounding a lot like Trump, because, you know, poor people overseas are a problem because they work for less. They're a problem here. And he's on the record as being against open borders, as a Koch brothers plot and all of this kind of stuff. He's going to manage the border in a way to keep immigrants out. I mean, he'll do it more humanely, I suspect, but he doesn't want low-wage workers coming into the U.S. And I think you see that consensus of a kind of industrial policy going on, but then also this narrative, which I think is a powerful one, although, you know, I think it's flawed, but the idea that the middle class somehow is doing awfully in America and that we need, you know, a fettered capitalism that distributes, you know, its benefits more widely, and that the state is the mechanism that will do that. I think that's what's coming up, and that the Democratic Party is kind of congealed around that set of ideas and the policies that are implied.
Suderman, I think Elizabeth Warren is becoming your new Kathleen Sebelius.
Wow,
it's a deep cut.
Wow,
deep cut for people. Out there. But she's clearly surging last in polls in state and national polls to the extent that we pay attention to them. She was even ahead of Joe Biden in a poll in Minnesota last week, which is pretty crazy. But like she's starting to get to be close to Bernie Sanders level here. Do you take anything of significance of her going up? And do you agree with my theory about this, which is just that she's totally the favorite of all political journalists?
There's definitely something to that theory. The fact that she puts out plans that you can write about, that you can analyze, that you can say, oh, look, she's just like, Even if you are sort of in the camp of like, well, I think these plans are kind of bad, she gives you material in a way that that other candidates are not at this point. And journalists like new material. In addition to that, she gives a pretty good interview. She's got a lot of detail. She sounds smart. She actually does understand policy, I think, at a more granular level than a lot of the other candidates. Although I also think a lot of her policies are both bad and in certain ways dishonest. So that's not to compliment her policies, but she is more knowledgeable about the policy environment than a lot of the other candidates are. I think the thing that stands out to me most about the race as a whole, and about Elizabeth Warren in particular, is the seamless way that the Democratic Socialists have merged with the Democratic mainstream. And so I wrote a piece last week kind of saying, well, there's a war going on in the Democratic Party between the socialists and the non-socialists. And I think that there is in certain ways, there's a conflict between kind of the mainstream, let's even call it the Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden camp and the Bernie Sanders camp. Which is, you know, sort of aggressively for democratic socialism. And Sanders in certain ways is losing, right? Like he has kind of capped out in the polls. He looks like he has kind of a base of support. He's having trouble expanding on it. But who is coming up in the ranks is Elizabeth Warren, who calls herself a capitalist, says she loves markets, is totally in favor of them, just wants to make sure they work for normal people, but is running on a somewhat smarter, slightly tweaked version of the Bernie Sanders agenda, and is serving. Even if she doesn't become the nominee, she is serving as a kind of a think tank for the Democratic Party going into 2020 in a way that, frankly, none of the kind of major policy institutions, right, that we would normally see doing that job are doing. I mean, the Center for American Progress is kind of a mess right now, which has traditionally filled that role. And so there is this kind of interesting thing happening where, on the one hand, there is a surface conflict between socialism or not socialism, you know, within the Democratic Party. And socialism is like, is losing on the surface and winning deep down. And it's kind of fascinating to see that happen.
Yeah, it's also losing. I mean, according to recent polls of the of people who identify as Democratic or as Democrats, right.
They want a more moderate party.
You know, a less ideological, you know, they want a moderate party. So it's kind of fascinating to see how this all shakes out. I do have to say, though, I mean, I think, you know, again, going back to the clip that we started the show with, the way Sanders talks about things, it's not that different than Donald Trump. Some of the emphases are different, but I think that's a powerful message that takes things away from socialism and it puts it more into you know, the realm of what is possible or what is even probable in American politics. I think it was a week ago or so, Liz Brown at Reason wrote about the, you know, surveys that show kind of the national mood. And we are, since the financial crisis, not surprisingly, we're in a swing where people generally want the government to be more active and to do more things to ensure
the national mood is happiness. As liberal as it has been since something like 1961.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, more important to focus on like how big should government be? Because for a long time, and this was something, Matt, you and I used to write about this all of the time about how like there was this persistent, you know, repeat of survey data saying that people wanted a government that did less, you know, and spent less, and like we're not there anymore. And you see this, you know, rolling into the Republican side of things where Trump, you know, nobody on the Republican side is talking about Trump wanting to increase spending or even regulatory reach into various aspects of, you know, of tech and other sectors of the economy. This is it's a bad time to be libertarian, I think, right now. I mean, or we need to get our best arguments out and be talking more about why when Sanders says that the middle class is somehow taking it on the chin, he is wrong. First off, as a matter of fact, that's not true. But then also what he's planning to do about it and Warren, you know, is not good.
Catherine, you are a connoisseur of democratic socialism and also the big bad ideas that we've seen in this race. Address a little bit the Suderman thing. I mean, this was supposed to be Bernie's big speech, you know, finally laying clear all these ideas. Sort of felt like it landed with a bit of a thud. But then meanwhile, if you look over at the Buttigieg's husband's Twitter account, which I know that you follow with great enthusiasm, it's all like, hey, you know what? Everyone supports a $15 minimum wage, federal, all over the place. So like, is Suderman right in the sense that even if Bernie himself specifically is demonstrating his ceiling all the time, like his ideas have infected everybody else?
Yeah, I think so. I think the question, though, is like clearly the interpersonal contagion is real in the Democratic field. Like he has given like socialism mononucleosis to everyone. But whether that, I don't know why. Anyway, it's the kissing disease, everyone. But whether or not translates to policy, I think, is genuinely unclear. Like, I think the minimum wage stuff is very interesting case study. It's happening on the state level. Sometimes stuff that's happening on the state level percolates up to the federal level, of course. You know, I think, though, that the reason that the speech didn't, you know, that people didn't like, oh, my God, now I understand that Bernie Sanders is the moderate socialist we've all been longing for, is because he has been giving that speech to try and make up for the stuff he said in 1976 for his whole career, and people rightly don't totally believe him when he says, no, I'm a reasonable guy who just wants to help the middle class. Like, even if people don't know the details, they remember, they know ish in their hearts that Bernie Sanders is, and Reason TV just had a great video chronicling all of this. You know, Bernie Sanders is the guy that said in the 70s, you know, in the long run, the problem of fleeing corporations must be dealt with on the national level by legislation, which will bring about the public ownership of the major means of production and their conversion into worker-controlled enterprises. He said that. He meant it. He still a little bit means it. And, you know, we know, I think all of us on this podcast have experienced the thing where you say, listen, I got a long-term plan and I got a short-term plan. And the long-term plan is anarchy, but the short-term plan is like, maybe we could reduce the marginal tax rates at the very top level. And also, you know, the First Step Act is pretty good. Like, we've all been there. It's a place that socialists are now finding themselves in American politics. And, you know, I think we could argue contra Nick, or also like pro other podcasts, Nick, that, you know, this is the model that we've been using for a long time. Hey, here's our radical idea. Here's some little ways to advance it. It can always feel like you're losing and still be a good time to be a libertarian and be winning. I think socialists are kind of in that situation right now with the Democratic Party. And I think, like libertarians with the Republican Party, if Democrats win, they will then be sort of shoveled off into a side room where they like won't embarrass the grownups and like muss up the pretty furniture.
Well, that depends on which Democrat wins, I think. But I think
Bernie, I think almost any Democrat who wins.
Even Elizabeth Warren?
Yeah.
I think that there's the other thing that's going along with this is the push to universalize all sorts of benefits. So it's, you know, Medicare for all, free college for all, et cetera. And these, you know, this is not socialism per se, but it is an expansion of kind of existing programs. And I think all of the Democrats, for the most part, have signed on to that. And of course, and Peter has written about this, the Republicans have effectively signed on to that for Medicare and Social Security and a couple of other things. And this troubles, I mean, what troubles me more than I don't, you know, really care about the Democrats versus the Republicans, but we are kind of moving towards this idea that somehow the American middle class has been hollowed out. We're now living it, you know, we maybe those of us on the coasts are doing fine, but, you know, there's this charred husk of a nation in the, between the two oceans, and we really need to universalize all kinds of benefits, and the government needs to be shifting more money to this middle class, which is dying. And it's a moment. I think it's bigger than either of the parties. But I do think, you know, Catherine, that in the Democratic Party, this mood is going to persist regardless of who wins. And I don't think it's going to be choked
out. Hasn't everyone been running on the middle class needs help from politicians for all of recorded?
But they haven't been saying, of course, and I mean, this is like, the 10th time I've, the 10th cycle where you hear, oh, your kids are going to have a lower standard of living than you will for the first time ever, et cetera. I think what's different, though, is that it used to be, and the solution to that was more immigration, more free trade, deregulation. The messages now are not that. They are, and the answer to this, I think, among Republicans as well as Democrats, is a more muscular government.
Can
that
I
does more shit for
raise? I'm going to raise a theory here, or put forth a theory that almost all of, not maybe not almost all of this, a huge amount, and possibly the majority of this, is just about healthcare, and that is. It's a very Suderman theory. It's true, and I saw on Catherine's face
like
as I said that,
full-fledged
just like
smirk that happened
on.
Here.
So Suderman, right?
Breaking
no,
news: Peter
right.
Suderman
Hashtag
thinks
Suderman
it's all
theory.
About healthcare.
But I think it's not quite exclusively about healthcare. And on the right, it's a little more about immigration too. But people are very anxious about the cost of healthcare and about the possibility that at some point in their lives, they or someone they love will be faced with a medical bill so ridiculously high that, like, the number doesn't matter anymore, that it's just an impossible number, and that they won't be able to afford it even if they have insurance, or that they will have just lost their insurance or whatever. And Medicare for All there's a reason that Medicare for All, single payer, is far and away the most popular and most prominent of the kind of nascent new democratic socialist policies. Free college, people like that. It's a big deal. Paying off college debt, like, certainly appeals to a lot of under 40s with college debt. But what people really like and have really gravitated towards is Medicare for All, single payer. And we've seen even a couple of polls in the last year or so showing that a majority of Republicans favor Medicare for All. Now, of course, it's also complex. What is Medicare for All? People don't always know. But it seems to me that just a huge amount of this is driven by anxiety over the fact that healthcare can be insanely expensive, that it's almost impossible to predict, and that people don't really don't trust their insurance companies to be there, even if they are reasonably well insured.
Yeah, I think that's plausible. I think there's a lot of it is coming out of healthcare.
And then that puts advocates in this weird practical morass. Which is to say that everywhere that they, like in Vermont, where they try to do Medicare for All or whatever, a single payer, When it comes time to doing it, they have to acknowledge that it's impossible. And that gap between a commonly held desire and wish and the reality of it doesn't feel very tenable.
Well, and the thing you get is Obamacare, right? I mean, that's what happened the first time, and we'll get like Obamacare, but more so.
We are already getting that. In fact, California, just last week, it hasn't gone all the way through yet, but has basically, their legislature has basically passed repassed the individual mandate. They are not the first state to do so. They also passed $100 million or so, roughly, it's a little less than that, in funding to pay for undocumented immigrants to get Medicaid. It's a narrow tranche of undocumented immigrants. It's not just any of them, but as part of propping up Obamacare. And that is what we are going to start seeing in blue states. And that is, in fact, that's the Nancy Pelosi argument, is that Democrats should stop talking about single payer and just talk about what they did in 2018, which she and Republican leadership have argued won them the midterm, is just let's just talk about pre-existing conditions and Obamacare. The Trump administration is suing to take down those pre-existing conditions rules, as well as the rest of the law. And like, there's a front page story in the New York Times just this morning about how Trump wants to have a policy to defeat, to like, or at least sort of counter Democrats on healthcare. And the rest of the Republican Party is like, dude, we don't have one. There isn't one that will work that we can talk about it. We should just not talk about it at all.
Although I wonder, you know, the biggest institutional obstacle to repeal and replace in the Republican version of it back in the earlier days of the Trump administration was a then rebellious bloc called the Freedom Caucus. I wonder what would happen. I mean, I presume, Peter,
the Freedom Caucus eventually came along with the policy that with the plan that passed in the House, and they
that's true.
They did eventually come around. The bill was rewritten somewhat. It was John McCain, more or less. It's a slightly reductive way of talking about it, but it was pretty much John McCain in the Senate, and also just this sense amongst the kind of the key votes in the Senate, the people who view themselves as deciders. This sense, which I think is certainly has some merit to it. And, you know, I mean, everybody who read my coverage was very clear. I did not like the bills that were put forth. I thought they were half-baked at best and really quite misguided. But there was a sense that the plans that were put forth were just not ready for prime time, that that they would be bad policy and bad politics for Republicans.
I will point out, I don't think it's the most interesting or important thing about the Democratic pre-race, but it's just a statistical anomaly that I enjoy sharing, which is that everybody in the field, if you look at polling averages, national polling averages, month by month, everybody in the field is declining with four exceptions. Those are the aforementioned Elizabeth Warren, who is gaining. Mayor Pete is now gaining again, and he's certainly gaining from his starting point, which was basically Wayne Messamville back in the day. Joe Biden has been basically flat at 30% forever, except for when he announced, when he bumped up, and now he's back down to 30%. But he's maintaining that. I think that's reflective of the theory that was put forth by George Will in his latest column. But he's basically, the restoring to normalcy vote. Make the bad man go away. He's an old person that we know. And so people who are feeling incredibly pragmatic, that's a solid block of the Democratic electorate. Any guesses as to the only other person? And it's really small, so I shouldn't even say this. Slade's going to come and hit me with an ugly stick.
Too late.
But any guesses of who is just inching forward from Messamville upward?
Swalwell?
No.
I don't actually know.
The Gravel?
Yeah, that sounds good.
No, I wish it was Gravel. Bill de Blasio. From 0 to 0.4 to 0.6.
Stop it. Those are too small numbers. Those are not real numbers.
It's a real groundswell.
I know.
Stop
it. But it makes me happy. Those are not real numbers, but no one else is doing that in the direction. Nick, before we bounce away from the topic, since you are our resident conversation about conversations haver, what conversations are not happening that are of value or importance or concern to you in this Democratic race so far? What aren't they talking about that they should be talking about or that just aren't seeming to interest voters or the candidates themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it's for me, it's spending and debt. It's just that, you know, we are on a prolonged, I mean, we're still like, you know, on a bender that started at least in the early 2000s and showing no sign of cutting back on that. And it's creeping me out that, you know, even Republicans who used to talk about this, at least when Obama was in office, you know, don't give a shit. And, you know, this, it's not going to end well. And nobody is talking about that. And the idea that, you know, we can keep spending more and more, including on defense and, you know, just the absolute lack of interest in anything having to do with outlays is really.
I had a sad moment this morning. We opened up a piece of mail here in the DC office that was from Heritage, and it was a donor mailing, and it had a giant calculator in it. Like one of those, you know, like the old people calculators where the numbers are really big and the buttons are really big.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I get it. Like they sent a calculator because, and then I was about to say a thing that would have made sense pre-Trump, which was like Heritage cares about debt and deficit. And this calculator was somehow tied to that, like to budget math in some way, because it's a gimmick, like the budget, you know, like the debt clock. And then I was like, oh, no, wait. They don't do that anymore. They don't care about that anymore. That's not a thing the Republican think tanks do now. It was actually just like a you, the donor, are give us like an incalculable amount of value joke. But I genuinely had this moment where I like fell backwards in time, remembered when Republican Party oriented entities in Washington did stuff like send a calculator to remind people about debt and deficit. Whoops, we don't live in that time now.
Just so that we don't get nastygrams from the Heritage press people, there's probably a couple of experts there who work on the budget who would disagree.
I'm sure that's true. But I think, though, of course, we all have buddies over at Heritage. There, it is 100% fair to say that is no longer a point of emphasis for them as an institution. They are very, very busy with other
just
stuff.
Just as it is no longer even a kind of a half-baked talking point for Republicans in Congress.
Yep.
I pay attention to what political parties say in opposition and what they don't say. It's kind of revealing. And traditionally, Democrats in opposition, when they don't control the White House, will bring up debt deficits because they go up under Republican presidents just as fast, if not faster, than they do under Democratic presidents. And that obviously is not happening now in the entire Democratic field. And I haven't looked at this too closely, but I can only say that I've seen it come up only with one candidate so far, and that's Beto O'Rourke. I presume it's happening. A couple of other people in there probably are talking about it, since there are a lot of would-be centrists running who are not getting any traction. The John Delaney's of the universe is probably mentioning it, and John Hickenlooper's and these people. But it's generally speaking not happening, and it's certainly not a topic of journalistic inquiry in the way that it had been, you know, in the first 4 years of the Obama administration, just because journalists cover conflict. And that was the source of a lot of conflict in Washington, was wrangling over the short term and long term debt deficits. Since people don't talk about it, journalists don't cover it anymore. And that's a cause for sad face. Speaking of sad faces,
I would say, though, that there's, you know, the New York Times ran a piece noting just last week, noting that Social Security is staring down a shortfall, that the fake trust fund will start to be drawn down this coming year, and that by the middle of the 2030s, that fake trust fund will be empty, and then Social Security will stop paying all of its benefits. And now, this wasn't a front page piece, but it is getting covered. The Wall Street Journal also published a piece about the budget mess and deficits last week. These things are getting written about. They're just not getting
talked about by candidates.
Traction at all.
Yeah.
Well, it's not clear that it's to anybody's benefit, right? I mean, to even be talking about this stuff. But I suspect, you know, Peter, as you're alluding to, that when the trust fund is gone, Social Security under current law can only pay out the amount of money that it takes in a given year. And most projections are now that that means that benefits will be cut down to like 77% of what they are now. And that fluctuates a little bit depending on the year and stuff. But unfortunately, I think what's going to happen with a lot of this stuff is that we're not going to fix it until we absolutely have to. And then we're going to do probably the second or third worst choice out of whatever is possible at that moment of crisis. And
the thrust of the New York Times piece, it was a reported piece, but one of those like analysis pieces where that there's a clear implication, right? It's not quite an opinion piece. Like, was
one expert, a widely respected person in his field, says this. Another expert, basically found.
Yeah. No, and the thrust was, we've got to figure out a way to fund these benefits at the end of this process, because it would be real bad if we weren't funding these benefits.
Fully.
That's what we're
going to
do.
Forever.
I think you're exactly right, is we are going to get to 1 or 2 years out and then talk about finding ways to fund the benefits. And then, you know, at the very last minute, Congress will vote probably to pay for these things and not actually raise money to do so.
Yeah, no, we're going to have a huge, huge, huge fight about whether to raise taxes on the rich to pay for the Social Security that we no longer can pay for, but that we also couldn't pay for the last 25 years.
Right. Which, of course, is fully funded by payroll taxes now, right?
Yeah.
So it's we are neither going to
raise taxes nor cut spending in any other area. We are instead going to borrow more money and hope for the best.
We're going to increase, we're going to lift the cap on payroll taxes. That's what's going to happen. You heard
that'll
it.
That'll happen at
that
some
is
point,
almost,
probably.
Yeah.
But then once you do that, that's it. That's a limited
then you used
pool
up,
of money.
You used up that thing, which also then there's still all the other things to pay for.
It is the largest, single, easy to get, not necessarily easy, but like straightforward to obtain pool of money left in American politics. And it will be used to pay for, to help fund Social Security. And then after that, like, I don't know what people are going to say after that when they're like, well, how will you pay for the rest of things?
Because, like, we'll raise
I didn't have another answer.
Yeah. I also wonder, like, I'm sure that many economists have already done work on this, and I should probably go find it, which is, you know, what new things are the rich people going to do to not pay that very much? Because
the good thing about the payroll tax is, increasing, you know, the amount that it's applied to is that it's hard to get around.
Well, it just means people will receive compensation in other forms.
Yeah, but there's a point between people making, you know, say like in the low six figures up through about $500,000 where they're not quite making enough where they get savvy enough to like hide their assets or hide their income, and it's mostly income. So I think it'll distort things in all sorts of ways, but it's actually a pretty safe bet.
Well, yes, and we won't be actually soaking the truly, truly rich.
We'll be soaking middling rich.
We'll be soaking the people who are quite well off and comfortable. Like basically,
they're still rich. Let's call them rich.
Yeah, they're totally rich.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking the top 10%.
But it will totally be, it will pitch the merely 1% against the 0.1%.
Yeah. But I think even like this is the thing, right? Like there is such a thing as trickle down tax evasion. And at first, only the 0.1% will figure out ways to not pay tax on money that they feel is theirs by right, because before there was an artificial cap on those type of payroll taxes. And then accountants and others will figure out how to package some of those solutions and push them down the chain, because that's how it always goes.
I will have you all know that my over this weekend, my 10-year-old came to me and was talking about the unfairness of New York sales taxes and was asking about, you know, shouldn't we just have one basic tax and that's it? So you don't have to like have all these things. And so
you were like, on a postcard, my friend?
Yeah. What's up, Junior Steve Forbes? but then, so I had to explain payroll taxes and point out that comes out of if she made $100 from the liquor store that she would pay into it, and the look of creeping horror on her face about how Social Security is arranged. So that was awareness one. And awareness two is that we had a party over our house last night, and she learned – along with the daughter of our art director, the joy of making bartending tips and unreported income. And so I think we have a JD to Chili style tax scofflaw on our hand, who's going to be evading payroll taxes from the age of 10 on.
May we all raise tiny to Chili's. That's my prayer for us. Not
tiny
like literally
is a
actually
great
the spawn
name.
Of Two Chili necessarily, although I'm sure that's working out fine for Wendy.
But. A plus to everyone. Let's shift.
May we all tip our bartenders.
Always tip.
That too.
In cash.
And early, before they pour. You get preferential treatment. This little tip I learned this past week. Anyways, shifting gears to a an issue that frosts the dead heart of Catherine Mangu Ward, as was pointed out in this morning's Reason Roundup by Robbie Suave. There are a series of rising tensions, series of them, in the Persian Gulf. Iran announced that the country's kind of blowing through its uranium limits, as had been previously agreed to in the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Trump administration is accusing Tehran of intentionally blowing up a couple of oil tankers, third-party countries. And Catherine's favorite senator, Tom Cotton, says that we should retaliate and that war would be super duper easy with Iran. Catherine, do you want to talk about how right Tom Cotton is, since you used to work for the Weekly Standard?
Oh my God, this dude. I mean, every single time I see Tom Cotton's name in any news article, it is immediately followed by the thing I believe is the most wrong. Like, it is incredible how reliable it is. In this case, yeah, okay. So something happens. There's some oil tankers. Something happens. It's unclear. Everyone has a different story. Everyone kind of gets on like medium alert and starts talking about whether or not we need to revisit our deal. And Tom Cotton is like, war. Like, he just is immediately goes all the way full hawk. In this case, he says that the attacks on commercial shipping warrant a retaliatory military strike, and then goes on to say, like, you know, probably we can do a couple of strikes and that'll take care of it. As if that's not how we wound up in Iraq. As if Iran isn't larger and more complicated and more dangerous of an enemy. As if wars are good and easy to win. Like, that is not right. That is not the correct answer to a small scuffle with a commercial ship. Don't do it. No war, please, Tom Cotton. And that is just, of course, one example of the many, many places where Tom Cotton's instincts run counter to Reason's editorial line and my own moral judgments.
This is not new from him in a lot of ways. And in last month, he gave an interview with PBS where the host asked him, could we win a war with Iran? And Cotton just shot back like under a millisecond, like 5G response time. Yes. And she, like, the host was like, that didn't take you very long. And here he just responds, two strikes, the first strike and the last strike. That is Tom Cotton.
That is such a douchebag thing to say.
Do you think his
never,
like
ever how a war has
his
gone.
Reddit handle is like Governor Newcomb?
Yeah.
Yes. Senator Newcomb,
Duke Newcomb, my friends. There's the
larger question here, though, about Trump's foreign policy. And again, you know, I mean, the 21st century, however bad it's been for kind of like the financial health of the government, the foreign policy has just been a disaster to disaster to disaster. And this is troubling because, yeah, this is exactly the kind of, you know, obscure and kind of, you know, weird event that has led to, you know, major wars in the past, you know, because it's taking place in a place where tensions are raised. We are not on good terms with European allies for a variety of reasons, you know, which you would want them to be kind of stepping in at this point to hold Iran to its deal that we dropped out of, et cetera. It's like, it's really, you know, we have been asleep at the switch on foreign policy for so long. It's just, it's truly terrifying, I think. And dealt with.
I just want to flag one more thing, which is that Cotton went out of his way to also say, to be very, very clear, that the president, of course, could do whatever he wanted in response to the,
yes,
to the shipping thing,
yeah,
without authorization.
He doesn't need that. Yeah, of course.
The first time that I was even aware really of Tom Cotton was at, what's it's not Comic-Con. Well, CPAC.
You know what, though? Let's go with maybe it is Comic-Con.
CPAC. There was a foreign policy confab hosted by KT McFarland. And it was like, oh, what's the future of foreign policy? And Tom Cotton was there, and he was advocating for, well you know, as a throat palate cleanser, we should do regime change in Iran. So he's been thinking about this very specifically for a long time. I mean, in fact, Peter, damn it, is not there a coherent and coherently awful Trump tilt against Iran and for Saudi Arabia as like proxy wars in the Middle East. That's kind of their theory of the case, isn't it?
The Trump administration certainly prefers Saudi Arabia and has been to some extent taken by Iran hawks in the Republican Party. However, Trump himself, this is the one place where I will, one of the few places maybe where I am kind of glad Trump is president, is that Trump's instincts are not deeply and fully formed, not super coherent. He doesn't have like a great libertarian ideology when it comes to foreign policy at all. But when it comes to the idea that we should be in a big, ugly shooting war with a major with a major international rival, Trump is resistant in a way that I think is certainly unusual and possibly unique in the Republican Party, and quite possibly would not have been the same with Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton, if Hillary Clinton were president, we might have already engaged or be prepping to engage in military action against Iran. And Trump just kind of doesn't like that idea. He's not comfortable with it, even though many of his close confidants, like Tom Cotton, who's quite close to the president, like John Bolton, a lot of his advisors are pretty hawkish when it comes to Iran. And so this is a rare place where I think that we are better off than, maybe not well off, but better off than the alternatives with Trump in the White House.
Catherine, this is kind of an evergreen question, but what about Mashippenlings?
Yeah. So this is an idea that Cotton is capitalizing on. He says explicitly, you know, ever since the days of George Washington, the U.S.'s, you know, most assiduous responses have been in defensive shipping lanes. And, you know, I think this is a place where, you know, even libertarians have to say, like, listen, it's true. In order to have free trade, there have to be shipping lanes. There has to be someone or some group of someones who takes responsibility for keeping these paths open. At the same time, I think it is almost impossible to distinguish between cases where the safety of shipping channels is actually compromised and cases where some people who want to go to war with some other people use an incident in a shipping lane as an inciting incident, regardless of anyone's belief about the underlying meaning of or cause of those incidents. And this, of course, you know, you see this with China and Taiwan for many, many decades. There are all kinds of places where if you're looking for a fight, all you need is one little explosion in a shipping lane. And so I think for people who say, listen, there are limited functions of the state, there are limited functions of coalitions of states, this is one of them. That's true. At the same time, you know, beware of, hey, you know, the two Spider-Mans pointing at each other and being like, that guy wants to start a war.
Cotton also, I mean, he specifically referred back to military action taken during the Reagan administration after attacks on tankers during the Iran-Iraq war there. And it's just a very different situation, that what happened under Reagan came after years of attacks, some dozens, if not hundreds of attacks, not whatever this may or may not have been.
Let's go to our end of podcast. What are you consuming in the cultural arena? I want to start with Catherine because I know who she's going to talk about. Go, Catherine.
I am consuming Robbie Suave's new book, y'all. Yay. It's out tomorrow. It's called Panic Attack. And then it has a subtitle that's something like The Youths and Trump and the Alt-Right and Antifa, and check it out.
campus, isn't it? Campus radicals in the age of Trump.
Yeah, that's probably it.
Young radicals in the age of Trump.
Okay. If you want to get a sneak peek before the book comes out tomorrow, you can read an excerpt on our website. You can listen to a podcast. You can watch a video, all featuring Robbie Suave. It's a good book, y'all. And I think a thing that it has going for it that might not be immediately obvious from a quick look is that it is not just about the left. It is also about the right. And there is a chapter where he sits down and talks. I was about to say he sits down and talks with Spencer Ackerman, but that's a whole different person.
Very
he talks
much
with
no.
Richard Spencer and other alt-right types, in addition to looking at and to some extent going after the dysfunctions of the campus left.
And that Spencer interview is fascinating in part because Spencer says that that libertarians are basically his worst enemy. That
yeah.
We believe all the opposite of whatever he like.
Yeah. In a way that
exact
that interview kind of foreshadows the thing that we talked about on this podcast last week, which is the ongoing disintegration of any alliance between the right, broadly understood, and libertarians, and the specific kind of scapegoating, finger pointing by the right of libertarianism, contrasting it with nationalism, national pride, identity politics on the right, and the needed return to traditional values, if such a thing is even a sentence we can say anymore.
But I think it really blows up a kind of leftist narrative about libertarians, which is that the libertarians are basically just the alt-right, and what Richard Spencer, who is the closest thing the alt-right has to a kind of
explicitly saying libertarians are my enemy.
Spokesperson.
Yep.
Well, and that he agrees with the left, in terms of kind of ethnic solidarity and a vision of a world where competing kind of ethnic identities or separate ethnic identities are managed by the state or some mechanism.
Nick, so. I was meaning to go ahead, finish, Kath.
No, I was just going to say you can get Robbie's book. Also, he took a few days off a couple weeks back to record the audiobook himself.
Oh.
So if you want Robbie to read you Robbie's book,
no.
I think there's an audiobook.
I want the soothing sounds of Robbie's voice reading me baseball books and children's literature, but I'll leave my fantasy life aside for the moment. Nick, I was meaning to ask you earlier, and I'll use Catherine's invocation of Lafaire French, David French, as an excuse.
Right.
You were over at FeeCon. You interviewed David French.
Yep.
I'm just kind of curious. Will and listeners, stay tuned for that conversation.
Yeah, that'll be going up. I believe that'll be going up on Wednesday. So we had,
but the kids out there. What are the kids? So what's the word on the street?
So FEE is the Foundation for Economic Education, and it's the oldest market-oriented libertarian think tank around or group. It started in the late 40s, and they have an annual conference that has about 500 people, and their target audience are kids, students, about 14 to 26 or so. It was a really great event for a lot of reasons. They have a new president in place, but the kids who show up there are really motivated and really interested in the ideas of kind of libertarian analysis and understanding of the world. And one thing that was very nice about it was pushing the idea of creative freedom along with things like economic freedom. So there was a lot of kind of interesting discussion of how art works and how innovation, just as you have it in the business realm and things like that, you also have it in the arts and whatnot and in the way people choose to live their lives. So it was very very uplifting that way and very positive. The conversation I had with David French is, it's interesting. We did not get into foreign policy, but we did talk a lot, and we've talked a lot about this amongst ourselves, of the, a difference between a kind of conservative understanding of the world and a classical liberal, and the idea that the state should be minimal and it should be kind of a referee. And although David French is himself an evangelical Christian with very specific ideas about how people should live their lives, he believes in this larger political framework, which is why he's being attacked by, kind of revanchist conservatives, because they feel they can't win because the illiberal left is not playing fair, and he's worried about the illiberal right along with the illiberal left. So it's an interesting conversation.
Suderman, what are you consuming?
I have been playing a video game called Commander Lilith and the Fight for Sanctuary. So it's actually a sub video game. It is a DLC, which stands for downloadable content, which is basically an expansion game on top of the 2012, that's right, 7 years old, game Borderlands 2. And so what I want to talk about, like, it's a fun game. It's a sort of big, weird shooter that's heavily gun-based. There's kind of RPG elements to it, right? Like, the game creates random guns that you can kind of pick up as you play through the game. And so there's something like 300,000 or 400,000, maybe more than that, different possible combinations of kind of types of weapons that you could potentially encounter within the game. But what's interesting, what I want to bring up, is that games have ceased to become just the one thing that you buy for $60 when you pick up the game and then you play through it and that's it and it never changes. And this is a kind of a great prime example of the ways that games have become infinitely expendable platforms. This is a game that that came out 7 years ago, and I played through it at the time. It took me 30 or 40 hours, and then about a year later, I played through a couple of the expansion packs, another couple dozen hours, and then here they're releasing, however many, 7 years later, they're releasing yet another basically whole new game on top of the old game that kind of uses the same elements, but is set in a new location that didn't exist before, has some new characters. And it's previewing, of course, the sequel that comes out in a few months, Borderlands 3. But it's really kind of fascinating to see how game developers are not thinking of games as a kind of a static thing anymore, right? It's not just the one thing that you buy. What you're buying is a starter pack so that you can play something that that will expand and change over time. And they're even going back and adding on and building onto games that are quite old by video game standards at this point.
I will use for my installment here a really great magazine piece written by a former recent colleague of ours, Carrie Howley, for New York Magazine. She did a profile of Tulsi Gabbard, who's running for president. And I commend it, not repass the headline, which I think emphasizes that she her and her family come from a kind of an interestingly weird sect. That word can throw people off, but it's
cult. Call it a cult.
But I think that they use it as a sect. I think, but whatever. Yeah.
That's because they're in the cult. Nobody ever thinks they're in the cult.
That's a Spider-Man, a double Spider-Man moment there, Nick. But no, it's a terrific profile, in part because she's sort of trying to wrap her arms around a cloud of figuring out who Gabbard is.
No.
What? What's wrong with that? Have you tried to wrap your arms around a cloud? It's hard.
That's like a bad Johnny Thunders alternative take. And you can't put your arms around a memory.
Only nuclear arms around a memory.
Give a cloud a hug for Tulsi.
You can't abort your kids with nuclear arms.
Anyways, there's a lot of kind of like sly condemnations or denunciations of the way that we talk about foreign policy, and that coming from Kerry's point of view. But also it's kind of a demonstration of the limitations of what you can know about another person. It's just a very well-written, interesting piece, and go check it out yourself. Nick,
to follow up on that question of the inscrutability of people and kind of reinvention or recreation, which also picks up on something Peter was talking about. My recommendation is the Martin Scorsese documentary about Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review tour, which took place in the mid-70s. And it is a phenomenal document that has a bunch of hoax elements in it. So there's like a fake filmmaker who they're interviewing about this, 45-year-old tour, 40-year tour, through small arenas that had an assemblage of people like, besides Dylan, it also had Roger McGuinn of the Byrds and Joni Mitchell. And it is just a phenomenal work of art. If you love Dylan, you will love it. It's got great footage. And also Dylan in his state now, he's like a character from a Borges short story, like Funes the Memorius, where his skin looks like sandpaper. It's like it's going to tear at any minute. And the way he talks, and you know he's kind of putting you on, but he's making references to things from 100 years ago and things that are super current. It's just really fascinating kind of discussion. There's great footage of Allen Ginsberg, who is one of the kind of mascots of the review. Really wonderful piece of art. And, again, focused on this idea. I mean, Dylan's authenticity is that he's always inauthentic, or that he's always changing. And this, it's just a really interesting meditation on American culture, as well as the 70s and kind of a dead period, because Matt, you'll enjoy it. There's a lot of footage of like bicentennial, like small town bicentennial events.
And so what you're saying is Bob Dylan was an early video game.
Yeah, he is the infinite expansion module.
I appreciate that attempt to talk across the generations to bridge the chasm there. That was good.
He is absolutely. I mean, he's an infinite expansion pack, and that's kind of his message, and that you go
Bob
where,
Dylan is an infinite expansion pack. Nick Gillespie, yeah. Ladies
there
and gentlemen.
There it is. I'll stop with
it's
that. But
DLC,
I mean, it's wonderful.
Content,
it is wonderful.
I would.
I thought that was like the Dylan expanded universe.
Only ad for people out there who don't consider themselves to be Dylan fans, but still like rock music. That tour and also the music that came out of it is absolutely phenomenal. Like, he was singing in top voice, but Mick Ronson, the guitar player from David Bowie, is out there on stage with him. It was as good of a band that has ever been assembled. It's just wonderful music, and you can hate Dylan and still enjoy the music from it. But you can also choose not to hate Dylan, as Nick does every day.
Is the music footage? Do they like actually let songs play out at length,
yes,
or you just
yeah.
let it getting clips a, and snippets sort
there's
of interrupted an, by other stuff?
There are a number of the songs that he was basically trying out a lot of the work that ended up on the album Desire, which I'm not a fan of, but there are long versions of a number of songs from Desire as well as other songs. Joan Baez is in it. She went on a tour with him, and it's. The musical performances are fantastic in the documentary, and Scorsese is very good at this, where sometimes there's snippets, and then, like, right when you want it to, like, he lets the whole song play out. There's also, the music has been released separately. I believe it's on Spotify as well, and really phenomenal.
Steve Hyden, the great rock critic, pointed out that with the if you had this documentary and then the classic Scorsese The Last Waltz, which is about the band having their last concert, he said Scorsese is the king of rock documentaries about the floppy hat era of rock.
Yeah, that's for sure. There's even like this is the type of if you're into intertextuality, right, which we all are these days and stuff, there's a moment
Catherine
where
just made it
I heard,
I heard that. I was, yeah. But
just,
Sharon Stone appears and claims to have met Bob Dylan on this tour and may or may not have like gone along with the tour for a little while, but she's wearing a Kiss t-shirt. And then there's a joke hint, which is not a bad read, that that Dylan performed in whiteface during this tour and that he got the idea from Gene Simmons of Kiss, like from hanging out with Gene Simmons of Kiss. And it's like, this is like, is it real? Is it not? Does it matter? It's just, it's endlessly, it's just filled with the, you know, Dylan's whole career is like a series of Easter eggs. And it's like this document, because part of it is hoax and part of it is real, is just filled with all of that kind of stuff. And it's very, very, incredible.
That is all the intertextuality we have time for. Thank you for listening out there. And again, stay tuned for great Nick Gillespie content, David French and other people throughout the week. And we'll be back next Monday as well. Sayonara.